It would definitely have an impact for the system.
Thank you. I'm substituting for my student, Edward Kraft, here, so you'll have to bear with me. And the reason Edward's not here is that he just recently took a job with NRCS as a soil scientist, so we're happy about that. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about probably more of a process than actual data, dealing with some of the things we've been working with in the Northern Plains. In 2010, the USDA NRCS established the or initiated the Rapid Carbon Assessment Program throughout the U.S., and their plans were pretty ambitious, and I'm not sure these are all correct figures here. These are the figures that we came up with going through the plan at the beginning of the period. But they were going to do a lot of sampling throughout the U.S. and try to correlate soil carbon levels with various land management practices and also different ecological type situations. They were also going to involve looking at some other databases. Most of their citing of their sites was through the National Resource Inventories to identify where to sample. But they also were relying on other programs like the SEEP program, the ARS Graysonet program, hopefully looking at data from university research plots, and also from the EPA National Wetland Condition Assessment. We were approached by our soil scientists in North Dakota because they felt that there was a need for more comprehensive information on soil storage under a variety of management conditions. And generally, if you're working with landowners, you're talking to landowners or farmers or land managers, there's some common questions that come up. The first is, how much carbon is stored in my system? And the second is, okay, if we get involved in some sort of a carbon contracting system, how much can I store in my system? Because that means dollars. And finally, many of them just want to know, how much carbon should I have in my soil based on, you know, maintaining high productivity. And as a researcher, you know, a lot of times, and I worked in extension for a while, so I learned to always answer very definitively, it depends. And it does depend on a lot of different elements. So one of the things that they wanted us to do is to do an extensive literature review for research that was conducted within the MO7 region of the NRCS. MO stands for MLRA Regional Office, which is headquartered in Bismarck, North Dakota. And one of the objectives they wanted to do was to develop a literature review similar to Liebig, who actually is at the ARS Research Center at Mandan, and covered some of this area, but also a more recent one and probably more extensive literature review is done by Prechtl in Europe. So with with that background in mind, we went ahead and proceeded. But first of all, MO7 is a large area, and it takes in four land resource regions, the region F, which is the Northern Great Plains Springweed region, which basically encompasses most of North and South Dakota, a little bit of Nebraska, part of Montana, and just the western edge of Minnesota. Other parts of the MO7, or parts of MO7, are in region G, which is the Western Great Plains Range and Irrigated Region, which is the western and sort of southwestern parts of the MO. The Central Great Plains Winter Wheat and Range Region, which is generally more to the south, all the way down, extending into Colorado. The region extends to Colorado, but not the MO. And then on the eastern side, the Central Feed Grains and Livestock Region. So we're talking about a fairly large, or several large land resource areas that potentially had data for them. Because of the MO although extending into these areas did not encompass all of the areas and is not an area of responsibility, we decided to focus on resource region F and just the close-in areas of G and H. The resource region M is more corn belt, and the climatic condition, the soils are much different than those in the northern Great Plains. Eddie was brought on to NRCS as a SCEP intern, and so most of the work he did was, or that's the way he was supported. Most of the work was done by going through the ISI Web of Knowledge, looking for literature that had been published, supplemented by our internal online e-journals index and thesis index, and there have been several graduate theses in the northern in North Dakota State that have dealt with carbon in soils, and then also using Google Scholar to try to capture some of the outliers. And once literature was identified, then he went through and actually went back through the literature to find any previous literature that was published on these topics, and ultimately developed an electronic database, initially in Excel and then expanded using an Access sort of a system by indexing all of the articles and then filing them under a number of different categories, usually by soil attributes, so that we could try to sort out the data and kind of match it up to the types of management and soils and climatic conditions that were involved. Some of the attributes looked at, of course, each item was assigned as it was identified an entry number in order to prevent duplication. And then, of course, the usual things, the title, the topic, authors, data publication, and so forth, was also included in the initial file. After the initial file is established, then he constructed another data file or set of data files looking at specifically carbon, because a lot of the papers out there do not specifically deal with carbon or carbon sequestration or research on carbon, but there's useful information in these items. So essentially developed files that included indexing by sample location, soil type, the types of treatments that were applied, depth of sampling, pH, texture, bulk density, and other things. And all of these are organized into, like I said, the Excel spreadsheets to collect the data and then later on placed within an Access database. An example of a table would be something like this, where this is categorized by temperature regime or location, management, the sampling depth, the carbon that was reported, the change in carbon that was reported, the number of years that were in these treatments, and of course the authors, so that we could identify who was doing the work. The issue, and this is for inventory number 14 there, article number 14 in his database, and so there's a number of different ways that this could be represented. And some of them actually crossed a number of different types of conditions. For example, you see this is the same paper that the research was done in a mesic temperature regime as well as a frigid temperature regime. And the locations where this was done is shown under the temperature regime there. So, the more we looked at it, the bigger the issue grew. Initially, we had hoped to do a data meta-analysis on all of this data. And then once we started looking at the data, we realized this was probably not something that could be reasonably accomplished. Most of the literature contains summarized data. If you do a meta-analysis, you really need the original data, or at least significant elements of the original data, so that you can look at the variation, distribution, and those sorts of things in the data. Another issue is that many times the research that we identified had objectives that had nothing to do with soil carbon. it may have been a tillage, it may be a crop response to tillage and fertilizer, for example. And oh, by the way, let's measure soil carbon or soil organic matter. And soil organic matter and soil carbon can be two different things. Just by the way they're measured. In addition, you know, the methodology was not necessarily standardized. The carbon methods, some were done by Walkley Black, some were done by LOI, some were by high temperature combustion, some were done by other methods. The other thing was that not all the sampling was to the same depth. Some people sampled to 0 to 20 centimeters, 0 to 15, 0 to 30, 1 meter, half a meter. You know, and once you start looking at this data, it kind of gives you a headache because you just they're just really hard to organize in the simple human mind, because human minds like simplicity. So we finally decided we couldn't do the meta-analysis, but maybe we could sort of approach it if we just use standard statistical techniques because of the fact that we did not have access to the original data. In fact, a lot of the authors of the original data no longer exist. They're gone. They died some time ago. And so essentially what we started looking at, just use some simple things like the SAS with a PROC-GLM, which is an unbalanced design type of analysis that you can do some mean separation and things like that within it. And so we decided to go this route. However, what we've tried to do is to cluster our soils by the most common soils that were reported, do an analysis, then add another, the next most common cluster, and also kind of geographically keep adding in to see how our data is distributing, you know, as we expand across a larger geographic basis. And the things we're looking at is, you know, how much carbon are we storing? You know, what's the carbon content soil? How much carbon are we storing? And what's the range and values we can get? Because that answers some of the three questions that most farmers will ask. Up to this point, we've identified about 120 literature items from basically the northern plains. And we've run the preliminary statistics. Now, I don't have any hard data to report yet because we've still got some work to do on it. But in general, if I can make general comments about how the data is falling out, is in general, the grassed type treatments come out the highest in carbon in the soil. Generally, and I'm saying here native grass is equal to restored grass, which would be equivalent to CRP. But the restored grass has many different management regimes. Some have been stated, some, you know, kind of vaguely stated, so it's really hard to pin down exactly what the management was. But generally, the grass treatments have higher carbon than the no-till, which has higher carbon than conservation tillage, which is higher than conventional tillage. The last two categories are kind of hard to separate because there are a lot of definitions for conservation tillage. And conventional tillage has changed, or at least the time that I've been working in the northern plains. Initially, conventional tillage was mobile plowing. Today, conventional tilling is chisel plowing. So how do we, in conservation tillage, chisel plowing is often considered a conservation tillage practice. So there's a lot of ambiguity in here. So essentially, we're still trying to develop this, but it's been an interesting enterprise because, you know, it really points out the need for focusing. If you're going to do carbon research, it doesn't pay to do, or it doesn't pay to evaluate literature that has had a 4-year, you know, it was a 4-year study. You know, by the way, we measured organic carbon. Because it's very difficult under a lot of our climatic regimes to be able to discriminate what the real changes in carbon are. So with that, I want to acknowledge the support and the people who have cooperated here. And I also have a picture of Eddie here talking with Mike Ulmer discussing the finer points of soils. So that's all I've got, but are there any questions?